Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to our edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Adam.
How's it going?
Oh, pretty good. It's raining today as we're recording this, so I get to actually get some work done on inside. I've been gardening so much that...
We finally don't have rain. I'm glad we gave it to you. It's been raining so much in New England. It's insane.
Well, it keeps you inside. You know, you can read a book.
Write a book.
Yeah. I know you're working on that. So.
Yeah. But yeah, actually, it's kind of fun. I wanted to share was I recently, you know, at this point, I think everybody knows my use case 7 idea. And, you know, the idea of how is your product used in ways that are more extreme than you would initially assume, but there's a couple of benefits.
It's not always more extreme. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's not always more extreme.
Use case 7 is how would Adam use your product?
How would Adam use it? Exactly. How would Adam use my product? And, you know, but it's so much more dynamic. And I started off with saying, you know, extreme, because when we define use cases, picture how we want it to be used. And then we do a lot of I see, you know, with teams I work with, a lot of iterations that happen later where you find out like, oh, it got used this way. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, we should have considered this. And they not only become this duality of do we design to these more extreme things because we want the bulletproof label, but also you end up modifying your base use cases. And so I just gave a talk on that was really fun for IEEE at MIT Lincoln Labs here at MIT, you know, University up here and the junction with Lincoln Labs. And I did a use case 7 talk. And the funny thing was I did my talk, but afterwards, all the questions, it basically turned into a workshop. And we did like the question and answer session for like another 25 minutes, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. But what got everybody going was the idea in use case 7 of the stress of doing nothing. You know, and so many times we don't think about what can happen when our products are doing nothing. And is that a stress? And I know you're in the printer industry, and one of the you know, the bigger cases I always refer to with that is how when printers became, you know, very high commodity, inexpensive, and, you know, even showing up in college dorm rooms, how do they handle the stress of not being used through the summer, right? Because a lot of them were wearing out from just sitting for so long and not being used.
Well, there was a particular failure mechanism with a certain formulation of ink that would drool and then crystallize. Mm-hmm. And so it would block the nozzles for the inkjet printers. And that's just one of many different ways. I'm thinking also of vehicles, internal combustion engines, right?
Yeah, which is actually, I know you know that's where I was headed with
it. Yeah.
But which is actually one of the ones I did. But actually, before we get off the printers, though, is that I think with the, you know, and you can tell me if that – they had to go back and reiterate their base use cases, right? Because they were picturing how it's used, the word use, right? The different types of people and use it, how frequency or, you know, this and that.
They would kind of say, oh, somebody's going to print 3 reams of paper a year and we'll average it out per week. And it didn't include that use case of 3 months of high temperature storage in a dorm room in the window.
So that's what I look to help my customers with. Like, let's stop and think about these. You know, that's my use case 7 exercise and tool. And, you know, it's interesting. Somebody might have said, hey, wait a minute. What if, you know, this is their summer house? What if, you know, and now that is something that they design in their base use case. But, that was an industry that actually went through that process. And that's what I look to help people not do and to do it the first time. Mm-hmm. But the car one is kind of interesting because I'm experiencing it. So I have.
You didn't buy another car, did you?
I did. But I'm actually later this afternoon going to register my Porsche that I purchased, which is going to be a use case 7 Porsche. It's a 78 911 that we talked about in a previous episode. I'm going to do both, resto mod, and backdating, which is where you mix some of the best features from different years of the same line of car. Mm-hmm. So it's a 78. So I'm going to grab some features from earlier 70s that were more advantageous for different reasons and things that are more recent technology that are more advantageous and kind of create this Frankenstein that's the best of everything.
Okay. But you get this new to you, old car. Does this tie into this not being used, that it would have been in storage for a while?
Exactly. So actually, it's not this one. It's my other one. It's, you know, I have that the other 78. I have the Datsun 280Z that I bought out in California and drove back 2 years ago that had 23,000 miles on it when I bought it.
Wow.
Crazy, right? So it's 40 years old, 23,000 miles.
And it got across country.
I flew out there and drove it back sight unseen. It was the craziest thing ever, not a single problem. And that's a whole crazy story into itself.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that I notice when it's cold, if I kind of get on it a little, you know, accelerate a little too hard when it's cold, I get a puff of smoke. And the smoke has a blue tinge to it, which means it's oil being burnt.
Right.
For a motor with 23,000 miles, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But in doing a tune-up with it, or actually making my 13-year-old daughter do it with me, not making her, but of course these kids I'm not sending out into the world without being able to rebuild a car on the side of the road. we're pulling the spark plugs, and I was teaching her how to use the spark plugs as a diagnostic tool. You know, what do they look like? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so spark plugs, if you remember, they have a white ceramic part in the tip, and then they have a, you know, they have basically an anode and cathode kind of thing going on there with different metal alloys. And I told her, I said, a really healthy combustion process, it'll look like a burnt marshmallow, like a correctly toasted marshmallow, not a burnt marshmallow, where it's white, but you see nice kind of caramel brown, you know, mm-hmm. areas, mm-hmm. you know, over a lot of it. And we pulled out one plug, and it had the telltale signs of its burning oil. And it was only one, right? So usually, you know,
well,
it had
what's
that,
the color for that? Is it more
it's
dark?
No. It's not just that. It looks wet. It's a black gooey. So picture tar, right? So it's kind of like you're burning tar. So basically, when you burn oil, it kind of boils down, right?
Right,
you know,
right.
And so these areas, and it kind of, you know, kind of can touch it, and it feels a little softer. So, and then there's of course the other diagnosis of you're running too rich and burning too much fuel, which is black carbon, you know, built up on there. Those are probably the three, you know, initial diagnostic observations.
So car tuning brought to you by Adam.
Yeah, exactly. Not that anybody does that anymore. But but usually, you know, you see something like that pretty uniformly. You know, you'd see that to some degree, some evidence of oil burning across all the cylinders because it's the piston rings wearing from high miles mm-hmm. or the valve seals wearing from high miles. You know, that's how rings and different seals wear is – you know, usage, cycling.
Right.
So you see some uniformity across. But this is very telling to see five of them that are burning perfectly and one that is oil in it. And it, instantly I knew what it was just from experience, but it would have taken some time to sit down and think about it if I didn't, is that in the valve train of a motor, you have your intake and exhaust valves, and they all go in sequence as the cylinders fire, you know, in an order.
Right.
So when you stop the motor, one of them has to be left open. Right, because that's the one that would be doing its job at that exact moment, whatever position the motor's left in. So, you know, there's a long passage of air to get to the cylinder from the open valve. It's either through the whole intake system or the whole exhaust system. So, any short period of time, it doesn't matter. And the system's been pretty recently refreshed with oil. Right, these metal surfaces all have oil on them.
Right,
but if you put a car away for an extremely long period of time, that one valve that's open is letting air and moisture into that one cylinder.
Small insects and
exactly.
everything else.
And remember, these are raw metals, right? Because this is metal on metal, and only the oil is protecting them. So the oil has long dripped away, you know, no matter how viscous it is. And you will effectively age that one either piston ring or valve seat, you know, very quickly. Because once corrosion starts, it damages the sealing surface. So, you know, I can basically tell you which, you know, intake or exhaust valve was open for all those years was put away. Because obviously the car wasn't, you know, the 23,000 miles over 40 years. That would be about 700 miles a year. Well, that's not what happened, right? I'm sure it was used regularly. Somebody bought it and was so in love with it, they just put it away to protect it, right?
Yeah, they polished it every Sunday and that's about it.
Yeah, and like, forgot about it, but they obviously didn't even run it. Like, they put it away and like didn't use it, because otherwise, if you ran it on a Sunday, it would stop in a different position, right?
Right. And the lubricant would travel through. And,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it really, for some period of its life, was just forgotten about to some degree. Or actually, weirdly enough, I have a race car. Actually, you know, it's funny. This is a little tangent, but this is going to happen to one of my old race cars. I had a Formula race car. It was a Formula F. And, you know, I ran it and loved it. I sold it to a guy who was buying it for his nephew, luckiest nephew in the world, because he wanted his nephew to race. And his nephew ended up not wanting it. And so he just put it in his office. So he's an executive with a big office. Mm-hmm. So I got a picture later of it sitting on hardwood floor in his office, this race car. And I'm like, and so, but one of my first thoughts is, what a tragedy, right? An amazing machine doing nothing. But secondly, it's going to stress the car out, right? You know, just
it's
sitting
there.
Not doing
what it's supposed to do.
Not doing what it's supposed to do. So it's kind of interesting then, you know, so maybe in this car case, it's not, you know, it's not, it happens, takes too long to happen, but that's exactly what occurred was a, you know, doing nothing is stressful use case seven.
Well, I'm going to take this off cars for just a second because.
Please do, because I'll just keep going.
I have road bikes, bicycles, like for triathlons and for road, just for riding a bike up and down the hills out here where I live. And, you know, after the winter, I haven't touched the bike. It's been in the garage. It's got stable temperature, all the other things. But all the tires are flat. And almost always, every time we get our little group together and go for a ride, we all have flats that first day. The first ride or within the first week of riding, we have to replace inner tubes on all of our bikes.
So what happens to the inner tubes?
Yeah, just sitting in the garage. Yeah,
they didn't. No, but I'm saying so. But what's happening? What's the chemistry that's happening? Do you think is it just getting dry and hard? Is it?
Yeah.
Is it dry rot or?
Well, it's oxidation. I'm quite sure. And it embrittles the rubber, or the butyl. Rubber that these things are made out of, and they're not real thick. They're not, you know, kids' bikes where it's a eighth inch thick wall. These are performance road bikes, so they're very conscious of their weight, but so they're pretty thin. Now, some amount of oxidation is good. It makes them more supple. It makes a better feel for the ride. And I only know that allegedly through how people prepare for the Tour de France and the pro bikes. They buy hundreds and hundreds of inner tubes and then age them at a certain temperature, you know, in a mountain on the north side of the slope and blah, blah, blah. And it makes a tangible difference to the ride.
Same thing with race car tires. You put them out in the sun for a certain period of time to get them. Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's part, you know, when they're new, it's like a new pair of shoes. They're too stiff. You get blisters. You got to break them in a little bit, and then they're great. And then when they break down a little bit further, now they don't support your feet. They don't. You get twist your ankle. You do all kinds of problems. So, the issue with the piston being stored open is one way that just doing nothing can cause problems, and it goes to all kinds of things, whether it's a seal or a plastic or. Although one thing that when you do nothing, it actually becomes more valuable. It's a household feature or home feature.
When you do nothing,
it's not the coffee pot. Coffee pot must work every day. No, the old glass in remember how glass was made for windows 200 years ago?
Yeah, like bubbles in it. And,
yeah, they'd pour it and it would go into the frame and they cut it and set it up. But even modern glass, it just takes a lot longer because of all the other elements that are into it. But the old style glass, the poured glass, it would have deformities, and even the best poured stuff would have small pieces or aspirations in it. But they will sag, right? The window thickness will be thinner at the top than the bottom.
Yeah, they're still flowing, yeah.
Right, and that's a sign that it really, really is old, and now it's more valuable.
Oh, okay. All right, so more of a novelty thing.
Yeah.
But so actually, wait, before we get off the tires, your bike tires, what do you think the mechanism is? Because effectively what you're saying is that if you heat cycle them and use them, this chemistry process doesn't happen. And usually heat accelerates a process. Because I also do know the same thing from car tires, and people do too, where you see dry rot, where you see cracks on car tires. And it's usually cars that have been sitting around, not cars being used.
Yeah.
And this is a question to our listeners, because I actually don't know. I don't know why with rubber that when it's not used, it has this accelerated chemistry reaction. Because do you have a point of comparison, a data point for a bike you use year-round where the tubes last longer?
Not really, no. I mean, anecdotally, because I used to use my bike to commute, and so it was used rain or shine all year round. Not quite every day, but pretty often. And I rarely, if ever, had a problem with it.
Yeah, so I think there's something to – right, so I think that there is something to this. This is a real doing nothing is stressful for rubber, and I'm kind of – now I'm really curious. What's the chemistry? Why does not heat cycling it make it go faster?
Yeah, I don't know. It's – It might not be the heat or part of it. It might be just the I have no idea. That's a good one for our audience. Somebody out there is a polymer scientist and probably could tell us.
It almost seems like it's bacterial based or something where you kill a mechanism, you know.
Oh, it is in my garage.
Yeah. Interesting.
There could be plenty of bacteria in there.
Yeah.
But it's not just me. We, you know, five or six of us get together for a ride in the springtime and everybody's like, you have plenty of spares.
Yeah. It's consistent right across. That's really interesting.
Yeah. No, but it's one of those things I've seen. Now, some failure mechanisms like paint on cars, right? We're not actively using those things, but they get in the hot sun of Arizona type things or along the coast with lots of salt, the paint fails. And we're not
the UV. Yeah. UV is a huge one.
Yeah. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about things that like your internal combustion engine, if you use it regularly, right. It tends to do a lot better. Now you still have wear out mechanisms, right. That will be invoked. So there's a balance, but just putting it in storage for 5 years, I mean, I know that there's probably a whole fleet of YouTube videos on how to store a car properly. It's, you know,
well, yeah, I mean, I have to do with my boat every season.
Suspensions and everything else, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's called fogging the motor, where it's a different type of oil that's a little bit waxy too, kind of, and you run the motor at idle and you basically spray this fog into the intake and it goes in and coats everything and it just stays on the surface a lot longer, you know, but exactly. Yeah.
Well, I remember that it was, you know, you got to drain fluids, you got to, I remember one guy when I was in college, one of the guys had a car, which was a rarity for us at school. And so he says, well, it's a road trip. We got to go get the car. We were in Kentucky at the time and we had to go back to New York. And so before we rented a car, we drove to New York, before we drop this off, we got to go shopping. We need those little crystals you put in your radiator to plug holes. I don't know what that is. Some silver stuff. We need a case of oil. We need windshield wiper fluid. We need brake fluid. We need transmission fluid.
Right.
We bought gallons of liquids and dumped all this stuff in this car and got it running. And it had only been stored for about 3 months. But it was an old Wyoming range or ranch car. That was absolutely abused. I think we've talked about that before. There's stories there. I never got in that car again after that trip.
And I'm done.
But it was, you know, the suspension was just horrible. He had retread tires and one of those blew up while we're traveling down the road. The spare was dead flat, of course. He didn't do any of the things that even then I knew you should have done. You need to not let your car rot. He didn't do any of that stuff.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So I encourage the teams out there to consider, you know, the stress of doing nothing, you know, and the whole use case 7 mindset. It's not that, you know, complex to say, hey, let's sit down and be a little creative here.
Yeah. You know, one group that does this well is the biomedical folks. When they have a chemistry or a solution or something that's going to have a shelf life, they actually test shelf lives and the efficacy of those drugs or solutions or chemicals after the shelf life period. The hard part is accelerating the shelf life. How do you accelerate not doing anything?
Yeah, exactly. That's where you have to really figure out the chemistry.
That's right.
And to see if you can find some model that you can accelerate that, which is a whole research project into itself, probably longer than just letting it sit on the shelf for 6 months. So only if you're going to reuse that model is it worth doing.
Yeah, the project manager doesn't want to wait the 2 years. Or, you know, it's like, no.
Oh, yeah, right. Exactly. Which goes back to my culture thing.
That's right. That's right.
Full circle.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. No, so I guess we should ask our, so what should we ask our audience this time?
If anybody can tell me why tires get stressed out doing nothing more than being used. B, I love when people share that their use case 7 style, things that they've found to characterize for their product, because sometimes they're great stories. They're really fascinating to hear how some. I love the ones where you hear how it was a ridiculous idea when it first got brought up. Everybody laughed, and then by the end of the session, they're like modifying use case 1 to include it. You know,
that's right.
They're
that's
like, right. Wait a minute, this is going to happen.
This is really going to happen. This is important. We need to make this real. Yeah. No, those are perfect. We'd love to hear from you on those. You can shelter or shield the names and people involved and companies and all that stuff, but share what you'd like. We'd love to hear those stories. Head over to AscendoReliability.com/go/SOR and join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. So with that, Adam, I think we'll wrap this one up.
Yeah, I'm going to go break something.
Oh, figures. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. All right, bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.